You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we go inside Lambeau Field's Section Yellow, where Packers fans are creating a safe space for sober support on game day. Now, today is Indigenous Peoples Day. This year, the Oneida Nation is marking 200 years of living in Wisconsin. The tribe signed a treaty in 1822 that established the Oneida Reservation on land that would later be inside the boundaries of the state of Wisconsin. The bicentennial serves as a celebration of their adopted home and a stark reminder of their forced relocation from their original protected land in the state of New York. We're learning more about the history of the tribe and how they made Wisconsin their home. Brandon Yellowbird Stevens is vice chairman of the Oneida Nation. Brandon, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
What does this 200-year mark mean to you and other members of the Oneida Nation?
What it means is just re-educating ourselves and reminding ourselves, you know, the long plight for the Oneidas coming from New York, upstate New York, and remembering that it wasn't always a nice, so bright history that we were removed from, usually around the Syracuse area, and having the Western encroachment, the New York's purchasing land from the Oneidas up in New York illegally, and having to sign the treaty, it wasn't necessarily a celebration. Mm-hmm. And so the 200-year commemoration really just highlights, you know, what our arrival to Wisconsin means, but also that brotherhood and sisterhood that we have with the Menominee Nation and the Ho-Chunk Nation here that were the first inhabitants of this area when we came.
I wanted to talk a little more about that earlier history. As I understand it, the Oneida Nation, their land was in theory protected under federal treaty in New York. New York State, as you mentioned, though, didn't honor that treaty. Can you talk a little more about that history?
So throughout the hundreds of years that we've been contesting that the illegal purchase of our land, we've actually won twice in the Supreme Court, saying that New York did in turn purchase the land without consent of the federal government, which is supposed to be kind of the mediator by constitution between states and tribes, and that didn't happen. And so in the Supreme Court cases, they did say that it was stolen, or not stolen, but purchased illegally. And so having that case won, we had to negotiate with the state of New York for remedy, because the Supreme Court basically said we cannot take the land back, but the state of New York had to provide some kind of remedy that would be an instance for the land, some kind of monetary settlement. Or in that period of time, in the late 1990s, we were in negotiations in early 2000s. We were negotiating with New York and other tribes a settlement, and their settlement clauses were basically trying to give us casinos, allowing casinos in the state of New York. And those fell through as a result of just New York politics is pretty convoluted over there. So those negotiations failed, but we are still have an active settlement claim over in New York.
Now here in 2022 in Wisconsin, what kind of things are you doing this year to commemorate this 200-year history?
Just as everything we're doing now, next year we're going to have a lot of festivities, just historical events that happened over the years. We're going to relive some of the battles. We're going to talk about some historical figures in Oneida history. We're going to talk about the treaties. We're basically trying to educate not only our community, but the broader community alike, that we have a long-standing relationship with the U.S. government that starts with the Revolutionary War. And having that conversation in education really invigorates why the Oneidas are here, but why the Oneida Nation fights so hard for jurisdiction and sovereignty of our areas, because we when we were called to arms by the 13 colonies, the United Nations answered.
You mentioned brotherhood and sisterhood with other tribes who were already here in Wisconsin. Can you talk about the relationship between Oneida and Menominee and others?
We have a very strong relationship with the Menominee and the Ho-Chunk in the area, and as also Stockbridge Muncie came over with us from New York. And so there's a strong relationship between the tribes in this area. A lot of our families are interconnected, interwoven. Now we have a lot of Oneida Menominees, Oneida Ho-Chunks, and so our communities are pretty strong. And we do, when we're speaking on the federal level, asking for more funding, adequate funding, treaty and trust responsibilities, we speak as one voice. And those are the things that we do as tribal leaders, is making sure that we are in constant communication on some of the struggles that we're having, and how we share those with our congressional representation in Washington, D.C.
And as we wrap up, you mentioned part of the goal of the commemorations this year and next year are education. What would you hope people from outside the Oneida community would know about the Oneida Nation in Wisconsin in the modern day?
One of the things, we always talk about how the makeup of the Constitution and the Articles of Confederation was based on the Iroquois Confederacy. And that goes back into our great law of peace, which is basically our rules, our Constitution that we follow. And Benjamin Franklin and the Founding Fathers utilized that method of democracy that we use for our Six Nations, and how that relates into current day structure, the three branches of separation. And so the same as we did with the Iroquois Confederacy. And then furthermore, when the Revolutionary War started, we were able to verify and register in the Wisconsin Historical Society a letter from George Washington dated September 28th, 1775, and it says, Washington writes, "The Massachusetts General Court introducing an Oneida chief who has arrived at the Continental Army encampment in Cambridge. Washington believes he has come in principally to satisfy his curiosity, but Washington hopes he will take a favorable report back to his people with important consequences to the American cause." And so that question that General Washington asked Oneida tribal leaders at that time was, will the Oneidas take up arms with the 13 colonies against the British? And so we did take that back, and we did join arms with the 13 colonies against the British. And we won a significant battle at Battle of Oriskany, and we helped Fort Stanwix, and also we helped George Washington cross the Delaware. And so when we say that, the Oneidas brought 600 bushels of corn to George Washington's starving army, and we fed them through the winter to make sure that they were strong enough to continue to fight. And so those are the things that we want to make sure that not the broader community, but all students and all community members, that Oneida had a significant impact on American history. And as long as we continue to have education and communication and conversations like this, we are able to find our commonalities in making sure that our communities and our municipalities and governments work together for all our communities.
Brandon, thanks for sharing this history with us.
Thank you.
Brandon Yellowbird Stevens is Vice Chairman of the Oneida Nation with us today to share the 200-year anniversary of the Oneida Nation in Wisconsin. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about a veteran whose world opened up after joining the military.
Lori McNeil Saylor of Kenosha knew before she graduated high school that she wanted to see the world. She was ready for something different, for new experiences outside of her childhood home in Alabama. So she joined the Navy, traveled the globe, and made lifelong friends from many cultures along the way. Saylor's daughter, Erica Saylor, interviewed her about her experiences as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices initiative.
My name is Lori McNeil Saylor. I am 59. I am also located in Kenosha, Wisconsin. I was originally born in Kalamazoo, Michigan. I moved to Mobile, Alabama after my mom passed. I was 4. And this wonderful woman named Alice adopted me. She already had 4 kids, my siblings. We grew up outside a lot, playing together, running around barefoot, just doing kid stuff. When did you enlist? I wanted to be somewhere other than Alabama. My thought process was I didn't want to go into 13th grade, as I put it, because I didn't want to go to school with the same people that I went to high school with. I wasn't really comfortable with a lot of those people. Mm-hmm. I was a lot shyer then. So when they came to the school, it sounded interesting and I signed up.
What was basic training like?
You know, it was so different because now you're living with people from all over the country. I think that's where my interest in learning about other people came from, because there were, like I said, people from different cultures. And I remember this one young lady, she was just this tiny little curly haired blonde. And she asked me, can I touch your hair? And I looked at her and I was just like, sure. And afterwards she said, why is your hair different from mine? And I said, because that's the way God made it. And she was like, oh. It was so easy for her to understand that.
Is there someone that you served with you remember fondly?
My 2 most favorites are your Aunt Flo and your Aunt Trina, because I met one on the bus and the other one in boot camp. And we've been friends for over 30 years.
How do you think your time in the military affected you?
It opened my eyes a great deal as far as education, how to save money, just things that I hadn't really learned yet. You know, it gave me a lot of opportunities, you know, semi-free education, traveling. It definitely opened up my world and gave me the travel bug. That's the one thing I think is probably one of the most awesome things that the military did for me. I was there when they first put women on board ships. I was there when the Cold War ended, when Russia came to Norfolk, Virginia. I got to see that, you know, and I think I still have a Coke bottle with the Russian writing on it. So there are things that I got to see and experience that a lot of people don't get to do. So,
and you never would have.
Right. So I'm very grateful for the things that I was able to accomplish in the military.
Do you have any advice for someone who is interested in joining?
I believe traveling, learning about other cultures, it's probably the best thing that you can do for your own sense of being. It helps you open up your mind and your eyes, and you get to learn so much. So definitely education, travel. And I always tell them, find someone you want to emulate when you first join. Find someone that you would like to be like, and you follow them around, you ask them questions, you learn from them. You know, just absorb it all, make it worthwhile.
Right.
So I wish someone had told me that when I was joining, but I figured it out on my own.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did. Yes, you did.
That was Lori McNeil Saylor of Kenosha, Wisconsin. She shared her experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices initiative, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
Coming up, we hear from 2 of the people who started the Sober Support Space for Packers fans, also known as Section Yellow, at Lambeau Field. That's next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. At their best, sporting events can be a great way to bring people with different backgrounds and perspectives together. It can also bring them together to drink alcohol, and sometimes lots of it. For people struggling with drug or alcohol addiction or just trying to moderate their consumption, games at big venues like Green Bay's Lambeau Field can make things difficult. That's where Lambeau's Section Yellow comes in, a project that helps promote sobriety while cheering on the home team. Our next guests are part of the Section Yellow Project and members of the Brown County Alcohol and Drugs Coalition for Change. Tom Doofman is Assistant Director of Counseling and Psychological Services at St. Norbert College, president of the nonprofit Section Sober, which promotes sobriety in Brown County. Tom, welcome to Central Time.
Hi there, Rob.
And John Plageman is a social worker with the Aging and Disability Resource Center of Brown County. John, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
John, let's start with you. Section Yellow, I understand, was your idea. Where'd it come from?
So it came from the kind of the jam band scene, which is heavily into alcohol and drugs. And I follow the Grateful Dead and Phish. And when I got sober in 2009, one of my biggest fears was, how am I going to, you know, keep doing the fun things I want to do? And I remember there was a show, Phish was coming back from a hiatus in 2009. And I was really excited to go to that show, but I was only about 3 or 4 months sober at that time. And I found the fellowship. The fellowship with the PH word in front of it, because that's kind of their shtick. They are a sober Phish fan group, and they actually have a table at every show. And I've been actually volunteering that since 2012. So come 2019, I'm getting ready to volunteer at the Phish shows at Alpine Valley for a 3-night run. And part of the coalition, we're leaving that after the meeting. And I just go up to Laura Hybe, who is kind of the chairperson of our coalition. And I'm like, hey, can we get this at Lambeau? Can we get this sober table at Lambeau? It's such a simple idea, but it has such a strong impact and such big support, because there are a ton of Packer fans that are sober that will not go to the games because of the drinking culture. So they're inspired the idea through the jam band world, and that sober table is exactly kind of how the idea started.
And Tom, how important is it to for people seeking sobriety to have this alternative in a place where a lot of the pressure, a lot of the signs point toward drinking?
Well, we have over 1,200 members on our Facebook group, and so we have a strong contingent of folks that are either sober themselves or supporting somebody that is living a sober lifestyle. And it's good to have an oasis in a place where you are surrounded by folks that are having a good time and sometimes having way too much of a good time. Just to know that somebody else has your back and that they acknowledge you're doing something that may not be in the norm, but it is supported.
John, can you paint us a picture of, if I walk up to Section Yellow at Lambeau, what happens?
Okay, so we're in the northwest end zone area. So we're by the Quick Trip gate by Section 110 and 112. We are by the designated driver booth, which is no longer there, but the kiosk is still there. So when you come up, you'll see a green tablecloth table with two volunteers who are in sobriety, and people come up and say, hey, I'm here, and you'll give them a sticker. And we have one game at a time sticker, because in recovery, it's one day at a time. So we give out one game at a time stickers, and we got Section Yellow stickers. And, you know, they can come just to know that we're there. That's the main thing, just to check in. We take pictures. We post it on Facebook. We're just there for support. The interesting thing from the last game, we normally get about 20-ish people. And the Patriots game, which was a Milwaukee season ticket holder game, I don't think it had anything to do with Milwaukee season ticket holder, but we had over 60 people come up to the table that day. It was a very, very busy event, and we were really happy to see a lot of people. This is starting to be a rolling stone and gathering some moss.
Tom, Wisconsin has a reputation, unfortunately, I think an earned reputation, for being a place where drinking is very normalized in lots of social settings, expected in some ways. Can you talk about the importance of normalizing the option of not drinking in social settings?
Yeah, it's kind of a unique situation where you can be in the midst of this culture where it's really normalized to have one or five drinks in an evening, where other places that might not be the case. I have not used drugs or alcohol since September of 1982. So I spent my entire college career not drinking, and I went to the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. So I've had a lot of practice at being around people that are consuming alcohol, but letting them know that it's not something I'm choosing to do, and they've been very supportive of it. So that's our main goal, is to let people know that you don't have to do this if you don't want to. And also, there are people that are choosing not to do this. And so when you think of Wisconsin and you think of the Packers, cheese, and beer, it's not always in that order. And some folks can appreciate all those things without using alcohol. So it's telling a story that's not often told.
John, in just our last minute or so, what is it like for you being at a fish show or being at Lambeau and having contact with people going through this, the same sorts of things in this setting?
It, you know, it's the feeling of not being alone and being supported and not feeling that you're out on an island is a very strong connection. It's almost like a spiritual connection. We can still listen to the music. We can still go to the Packer games and cheer just as loud. And the emotional content that I feel at either, whether it's going to a Packer game or going to a concert, is just truly, truly amazing. So the one thing we just want to let people know is that if they're sober curious or they want to be a sober ally, to come to the Facebook group, join the Facebook group. All the information is there. And just know you're not alone.
Thanks to both of our guests for joining us today, John Plageman and Tom Doofman, both involved in the creation of Section Yellow, a sober, encouraging environment at Lambeau Field. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we continue our review of some big issues in the midterm elections with a focus on crime, public safety, and police funding, and how those topics have come up in the political debate. And can we feel better as we get older? We'll get lots of advice on healthier aging with the author of the new book, The Great Age Reboot, Cracking the Longevity Code for a Younger Tomorrow. That and more, it's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then the Earth may be in the midst of a new wave of extinctions, many of them caused by humans. We'll look at the last survivors of species and the lessons they can share for the future with the author of the new book, Endlings, Fables for the Anthropocene. I'm Rob Verrett. You're listening to Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, President Biden issued pardons for all federal convictions for simple marijuana possession. We'll explore what this change in pot policy could mean in the future. First, according to biologists, there have been five known mass extinction events in the history of life on Earth. The last extinction happened roughly 66 million years ago, when dinosaurs were most likely wiped out by an asteroid. It appears there's another mass extinction event going on right now. The current extinction event is unique in that its source is largely human activity. The UN Convention on Biological Diversity estimates that 150 species die each day, a number that can be difficult to wrap our heads around. Our next guest says there's something that can help us comprehend mass extinction. She takes a close look at the stories of endlings, a word used to mean the last individual left in a species, like Lonesome George, the last Pinta Island tortoise who died in 2012, and Benjamin, the Tasmanian tiger who died in 1933. We're listening back to that conversation now. You could still get in touch. Is there an extinct species that really interests you? Is there an endangered animal you're especially concerned about? Have you worked in conservation yourself? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. Lydia Pine is a writer and historian. Her most recent book is Endlings, Fables for the Anthropocene. We talked to her earlier this year. Endling was a new word to me, I got to say, Lydia, and it's pretty new in and of itself. Can you talk about the origins of this word, endling?
Sure. So, pardon me. So, as you pointed out, an endling is defined as the last known individual of a species before that species goes extinct. And the word sort of came into being around 1996 when biologists were doing conservation work, but also working with people who had come to understand that they were going to be the last of their family. And we're looking for a word that would sort of have a poignancy about what it would be to be the end of something. And a couple of different words are tried out in the literatures, but endling is the one that sticks. It's really specific. It's really interesting, and it really piques a kind of curiosity, I think.
A big point of your book is that it matters how we talk about extinction and about these species and their last members. How does the word endling help do that, do you think?
So I think endling is a word that is really easy to gravitate toward. I joke that it took a long time when I was writing the book. It took a long time for Word to stop auto-correcting endling to ending. Mm-hmm. But I think that there's a real sort of crossover between endling and ending and sort of how we think about extinction and the ends of things. And I think endling is a word that gives us a character to build out extinction stories around.
You end the book, if you don't mind me spoiling your last line.
No, please.
Quoting here, we owe it to these endlings to tell their stories in as many words and narratives as possible. Why is that?
So when I was digging into the history of endlings and how we talk about these last of their species and these last survivors, I was really struck by how Western-centric these stories are, that we could find echoes of these stories in classic works like Beowulf or the King Arthur legend or all sorts of these sort of classic pieces of literature. And I wanted to, as part of this book, I wanted to be able to expand the kinds of literature and the kinds of words and the kinds of stories that we could use to talk about extinction and hopefully have a richer understanding of what loss means.
One practical hope, I think, for talking about these endlings, these last members of their species, would be, I guess, a cautionary tale. We have lots of those in the history of stories here. Something that tells us, hey, by the time it's gotten to this last one, it's too late, and maybe inspires us to care for other species. That's just one narrative. Is that an important one, though?
I think it is. I see these sort of cautionary tales. It feels like they almost function like an Aesop's Fables, like a modern Aesop's Fables, where these stories hopefully inspire a kind of lesson or sort of inspire us to be better humans or inspire us to consider these animals in their own stories. And I think that endlings are a way of putting that kind of character, putting a face, a persona onto something that's really abstract. So when you kicked off the segment, you pointed out that estimates put about 150 species a day going extinct. And I personally think that that's really hard to wrap my mind around, it's horrible, but it's very abstract. But when I dig into the story of Benjamin the Thylacine or Lonesome George the Galapagos Tortoise, suddenly I feel like I have an understanding that simply statistics and numbers don't necessarily provide.
Talking to Lydia Pine about her new book. It's called Endlings, Fables for the Anthropocene. You can join in with your thoughts, your concerns about endangered species, your question for our guest about this concept of endlings, the last of a species. 800-642-1234 is the number to call if you'd like to join in. 800-642-1234. I want to meet some of the endlings. And you just mentioned one, Benjamin the Thylacine or Tasmanian tiger, some people call him. First of all, tell us a little bit about this species.
Sure. So the species, the thylacine, the Tasmanian tiger, I think in some literatures they're also called Tasmanian wolves or hyenas, was a species that was common in Australia and Tasmania about 2 million years ago. And up through Europe, and it slowly goes extinct over the Australian mainland. And then by the time European settlers reach Tasmania, there are about 5,000 thylacines on the island of Tasmania. European settlers hunt the thylacine to extinction. It's really quite a vicious sort of extinction event in the 19th and early 20th century. And eventually, the last thylacine, the last known thylacine, is a captive thylacine that we've come to call Benjamin, who lived in a zoo in Hobart until he died in 1936 from exposure from the elements. It's really quite a tragic death to a sad extinction event.
Right. I got to say, in the storytelling here, and I'm putting human terms on an animal, which we do it, it seemed very undignified. Like the last member of the species was treated with very little dignity. Can you talk about that?
It feels oftentimes, I think, really cruel. And I think that it also helps us to really put actions and consequences together. Again, having a character or a persona or a specific individual, I think, helps us understand the actions and consequences in ways that I think are more abstract when we talk about bigger populations or species in general.
And Benjamin, I mean, the story that ends up being told about this thylacine, this Tasmanian tiger, first of all, he wasn't Benjamin. And I don't think, if I read right, he wasn't a he.
Yeah, so the debate is kind of open as to whether he is a he or whether, whether he's called Benjamin at all. And historical records seem to point that while Benjamin was alive, he wasn't called Benjamin. And that this is sort of a myth, a story that gets built up in the years after Benjamin's death. And I think today it's impossible to talk about this individual without sort of having this myth, this story of Benjamin that gets built up after his death as part of that. And so one of the interesting parts, I think, about the story of Benjamin is how this last individual really spurs on conservation efforts in the late 20th century in Tasmania, in Australia, and Benjamin, such that he is, becomes this icon and this sort of focal point.
We're talking to Lydia Pine about her new book. It's called Endlings, Fables for the Anthropocene, about the stories of endlings, the last individuals of a species amid the Earth's sixth mass extinction. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about this current, what appears to be mass extinction? Do you think humans should do more to prevent the extinction of species? Is there a particular threatened species or one we've lost that you've been particularly interested in that you feel a connection to for one reason or another? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Lydia Pine, looking at her book, Endlings, Fables for the Anthropocene, about endlings, the word for the last living individual of a species that goes extinct, and how we think about them, how we tell their stories. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe your examples, a species of particular concern to you if you want to bring it up. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your own stories if you've worked on conservation. Let's bring on a caller now. Joshua is with us in Viroqua. Joshua, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Joshua?
Yeah, so the late great passenger pigeons, such an amazing story, and I was wondering if your guest writer had any stories about those endlings.
Joshua, thanks for the call. I don't think you have a chapter on the passenger pigeon. I don't know if we know about the last exact member of it. We've got, as I mentioned earlier, a memorial to the passenger pigeon, which once, I guess, filled the skies of North America and is now gone. Any thoughts, Lydia?
Sure. So Martha is actually the endling, the passenger pigeon endling. And there are many memorials to Martha and sort of marking this last of a species. What's really interesting, I think, about the story of Martha is that she's widely recognized, even at the point of her death and her species extinction, she's recognized as this last of her kind. But the word endling doesn't exist yet to be able to ascribe to her, to describe her. And so it the endling part of her story, I think, is one that comes much later in the 20th century. A sort of interesting factoid about Martha that I learned when I was digging into endling stories is the zoo where Martha died actually had the last two Carolina parakeets, the endling and almost endling. They were called Incas and Lady Jane. And so it's sort of an interesting coincidence that one place that's doing bird conservation work ends up with two last endlings.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Let's stay with birds for a moment. We had a parakeet in North America, in the United States, actually, a long time ago,
yeah.
The Carolina parakeet. Can you tell us about the story of what you call a charismatic endling?
I think that it is an incredibly charismatic, endling and an incredibly charismatic bird. So as I mentioned, the last two endlings end up in the Cincinnati Zoo. They're Incas and Lady Jane, and they're purportedly devoted to each other. And in the tellings of these endling stories, Lady Jane dies first, and the zookeepers and conservators and curators all say that Incas had died of a broken heart, and that's finally what finished him off. And I read these stories, and I thought, oh my goodness, this just feels almost Arthurian in its telling, that you have this hero that's dying of a broken heart. And I felt like that was a really interesting way to think about and to frame this last Carolina parakeet.
Let's bring on another caller now at 800-642-1234. Bill is with us in Barneveld. Bill, hello.
Hi, great program. Taking my call. Preservation based here in the Salaw Foundation, which is working to save what's probably the most endangered large mammal in the world now, a thing called the Salaw. This looks kind of like an antelope. It was only discovered in Vietnam in 1992. You know, I get asked, you know, why are you guys trying to do this? I mean, what's, you know, there's not many of these things left. What's the point of saving this? And I just like to weigh in with an answer I often give, or my perspective is, you know, people never ask, say, the curators at the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam, why are you doing this? Why are you saving Van Gogh's paintings? Well, they're saving him because it's this beautiful thing, his paintings, these beautiful things in the world, and the world would be much less rich without them. And the same thing for the Salaw. It's this amazingly beautiful animal, and simply its beauty, that's enough reason for us. We don't have to make, you know, ecosystem economic arguments to say that just having this animal in the world a bit longer, even if we never get a chance to see it ourselves, makes the world a richer and better place. So
Bill, thanks for that call. That's the Salaw. I looked it up, S-A-O-L-A. What do you think of Bill's motivation, Lydia?
Oh my goodness, that was so beautifully put. I really appreciated him sharing his experience, and I really like the analogy that he offered. That was really fantastic.
Thanks for calling in, Bill, at 800-642-1234. Tony is with us now in Ann Arbor. Tony, hi.
Hey, how's it going? I think that there's really not a lot of debate that we are the most invasive species on Earth. And I think that with our presence, we've caused a lot of other species to die off, or endlings. And I think we're missing a great opportunity to redirect our focus instead of trying to save the planet from global climate change, that we should just give palliative care to the people that are here now and just let us go the way of the dinosaurs and let the Earth recover after she rids herself of us.
Tony, thanks for the call. Lydia, a very drastic solution, eliminate humans from the picture. I'm guessing, I don't know, I'm assuming you're not going to jump on board with that, but short of that, do you think there's more we could do?
I think that one of the points that I think Tony raised is really interesting, in that the sort of, how do we think about bearing responsibility? And in digging through endling stories and in digging through how we talk about extinction, I think that there's definitely space for humans to assume the blame for harm that we have caused.
Tony, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Lydia Pine is with us. We're talking about her new book. It's called Endlings, Fables for the Anthropocene. She looks at stories of the last members of species that have gone extinct and the stories we tell about them and why we tell them. Lydia, it seems to me this would be a tough project to do, right? I mean, I look at these stories and I honestly kind of want to look away. It's kind of painful and hard to confront. What kept you going to confront these stories?
it felt like, so I wrote the book during the pandemic, during the sort of first part of the pandemic, and it felt like a way to channel frustration. It felt like a way to talk about things that I felt were really hard. It felt like a way to talk about grief. But one of the other things that sort of inspired the project and spurred it on was reading a new translation of Beowulf by Maria Devana Headley, who uses the word extinct in her translation to talk about what it is for this warrior to be the last person that survives this battle. And that moment was such an inspiration in what could literature tell us about thinking about loss and grief and the last of their kind, that I really wanted to find ways to explore that with non-human species.
Now, not all non-human species are, I guess, photogenic or charismatic. Can you make the case that we should be thinking about the other species that may not tug at our heartstrings, that may not have that sympathetic story?
Yeah, so I can actually offer like a personal experience that was a really humbling one when I put it together. So in the book, I talk about a plant called a woods cycad. It looks sort of like a palm tree. They're not palm trees, but they look kind of like palm trees. And there's only one plant, only one of wood cycad that's in the world. But because it's a clone, there are several copies of it in various botanical gardens around the world. And I realized when I was tracking down sort of at each point, where would these individuals be, these multiple endlings, where would they be? And I realized I had actually seen one in person and hadn't realized it. And it was such a humbling experience to think, wow, because this isn't a charismatic rhinoceros or it's not a charismatic megafauna, I didn't put it together what I was seeing, the enormity of what I was seeing. And that to me was a really sobering way of understanding the role that charisma can have in species that we care about and what species stories we talk about.
Time for one more caller. Willie is with us on the line in Madison. Willie, hi.
Hi. Years ago, it was probably in the 70s, I was at the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago. There I saw a stuffed whooping crane. And the little caption on the bird said, "There are only about 15 of the individuals of this species remaining, and the species will most certainly go extinct within the next few decades." Well, interestingly enough, I flew an airplane down to the little airport on the lake in downtown Chicago, and I flew back. And on my way flying back, I saw a flock of cranes with a few whooping cranes in it. And I realized that, you know, they talked about down to 15 in the species number at that time and that it would go extinct. It did not.
Willie, thanks for the call. We don't have a lot of time left. Wisconsin, Baraboo, Wisconsin, the International Crane Foundation, a big part of whooping crane revival efforts. Lydia, Willie pointed toward a case where we came back from the brink.
I love that. It sort of offers, I think, a balance to the sadness, the trauma, and the grief that we often associate with endlings and with extinction. It's exciting to hear of success stories, I think.
Thanks for that call, Willie. And Lydia, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Lydia Pine is a writer and historian. We listened back to our conversation with her about the book Endlings, Fables for the Anthropocene, looking at the last living individuals of species and how we tell their stories. Coming up after the news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, we'll talk to a marijuana policy expert about President Biden's pardons for simple possession and how the federal government classifies the drug, plus marijuana and its role in the midterm elections this year. I'm Rob Barrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.